there really isn't clear, good research on the fact that active learning is more effective than lecturing. It's one of the most pervasive statements out there, is active learning is better than lecturing. You know what? That's not really even a testable hypothesis, but it's not what the research says. I mean, quickly, people will point out several of the studies that have come out just recently, just like Scott Freeman, who wrote a wonderful meta-analysis out of biology. He's from UW. But his study doesn't say active learning is better than lecturing.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Welcome to the Digital to Learn podcast. I'm here with my co-host, Tiffany Snyder.
Hi.
How are you, Tiffany?
I'm doing really well.
I'm especially excited today because our guest is Todd Zagrashek. Todd Zagrashek is an associate research professor and associate director of fellowship programs in the Department of Family Medicine at the University of North Carolina. In addition to his work at UNC, Todd serves on several boards of many journals and organizations focusing on teaching and learning. Todd has a primary role in coordinating 8 annual Lilly conferences and workshops around the country that focus on evidence-based practices in teaching and learning. Todd has a wide range of interests and passions. His current academic work and publications pertain to faculty development, effective instructional strategies, and student learning. Topics in his most recent publications include developing a scholarship of teaching and learning-based course, the new science of learning, and seeking expert assistance from colleagues. He has also co-edited a special volume of the Journal of Excellence on College Teaching, Teaching for Brain-Based Learning. Todd has been a visiting professor and delivered keynote addresses at over 200 campuses and teaching conferences. Todd earned a bachelor's degree in psychology from Lake Superior State University and master's and PhD from Ohio University in industrial and organizational psychology. He has been at UNC since 2008. Todd, welcome to the Digital to Learn podcast.
Well, thank you, Brad. Appreciate that.
One of the things we like to start with are just some ridiculously silly questions so our guest audience can get to know you a little better. The first one is, sure. Would you rather never lose your phone again or never lose your keys again?
Oh, the phone. Totally phone.
Why is that?
All the keys are going to do is like get you to where you want to go, which is in your car. So basically it prohibits you from getting into your car and going somewhere. The phone has a computer built in, which can take you anywhere. So, yeah.
Okay.
Would you rather be an amazing painter or a brilliant mathematician?
Oh, totally a brilliant mathematician. That's an easy one too. You can't paint without math. It's not even possible.
That's good.
So, if you're not a brilliant mathematician, you can't be an amazing painter. So, you know, be a brilliant mathematician for sure.
You're being much too logical about this.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of person would pick mathematician, right, Brad?
That's true. Would you rather have a bottomless box of Lego, say that 3 times, or a bottomless gas tank?
Oh my gosh, these are also easy. This is great. Definitely the bottomless gas tank, because if you have a bottomless box of Legos, they're eventually going to come out of the Legos, and I hate stepping on Legos.
That is one of the most painful experiences for any human being, I think.
Yeah. But if you ask me whether I had the ability to give to my sister-in-law a bottomless tank of gas or a bottomless box of Legos, it'd totally be the Legos because it'd be hilarious.
Well, remember, you might have a bottomless gas tank, but you can't find your keys, so.
That's true.
Well, don't even need, that's true, good point.
Would you rather have amazingly fast typing and texting speed or be able to read ridiculously fast?
Oh my gosh, Brad's going to be all over me on this one. But see, either one of these is kind of a lose-lose situation because the cognitive processing is what's really behind this. So if I could read ridiculously fast but not process the material, that's not going to help me. However, I'm probably better off reading ridiculously fast because typing ridiculously fast would definitely require the cognitive thought process to basically feed those thoughts or those concepts into the ridiculously fast typing. So let's go with the reading on this one.
Huh, very good. Very good. This is probably a good time to do a little promo for your teaching for brain-based learning? Because everything seems to go back to that.
It's my life. I mean, it's so obvious. It is. And this is why if you come to the Institute in the spring for 2.5 days, we do nothing but talk about these things.
Awesome.
Only from Lily.
We're going to give you a chance before we leave to do a little plug for those great conferences and also put some resources on our website.
That's cool. I just thought I'd take the advantage of doing the 15-second intro of the spot there.
We'll weave those in throughout our time together this morning.
That's funny.
So would you rather never run out of battery power for whatever phone or tablet you own, or always have free Wi-Fi wherever you go?
Oh, definitely never run out of battery power for the phone, because the phone has... Ready for this one, Brad?
Okay.
Pretty logical on these things. I have unlimited data on my phone, so as long as I have my phone, I can always set up a hotspot, and that will give me my Wi-Fi.
There you go.
It's true.
We're going to have to think of some different types of questions for him.
It's
just too logical. Try this one.
Would you rather be able to detect any lie that you hear or get away with any lie that you tell?
And make sure you don't lie.
Any lie you hear or any lie that you tell. Ooh, that is intriguing.
Oh, good.
I would definitely go with detecting any lie I hear, because my integrity would prohibit me from lying.
Absolutely.
And if I don't lie and I could detect other people's lies, then we would have a truthful scenario. Oh, I like that one.
Very good. Wow. Last question. Would you rather never hear music again or lose the ability to read?
Oh, see, you saved these tough ones for the end. Let's see, never hear music again or lose the ability to read. We'd really be sad about the music because, you know, I'm an old-time saxophone player, tenor sax, actually, and I love the music. But if you lose the ability to read, oh, but you could still hear. So if I can't read, I could still have someone read to me. Books on tape wouldn't require reading.
True. Aha. There you go.
I'm going to go that route.
You found a loophole.
I want to be able to still hear. I got my loophole because I could just have people read to me. The only problem I'd have is they'd have to be able to read ridiculously fast.
Yeah.
Now we're going to get to some serious questions.
That was fun.
These will be easy for you. A little preface to this. I've had the privilege of attending several of the Lily conferences, and it's always fun to be together with a community of people who truly embrace teaching and learning, but also to watch you talk about your passion for this area and how much you care about it. So when you think back over your history, who have been your heroes or mentors that drew you into this field of teaching and learning?
So I guess I'd have to go with two steps here, probably. The first one is just that concept of who got me into education. And that probably goes back to Tim Sawyer at Lake Superior State. He was an individual who was the intro psych teacher, and I actually went to college to become a state police officer. That was my goal.
Really?
Yeah, I started college a little bit early at 17, so I lived right across the street in Cadillac, Michigan, directly across the street from a state police post. And I remember this too, I was walking across the street and I said, "Hey, I want to be a state trooper. What do you suggest?" And they said, "Well, you're 17 now. You got to be 21. Go get a college degree because a bachelor's degree is going to really help you out later." And this was back in 1979. And I said, okay. And I looked around in criminal justice. That was a good program up at Lake Superior State. So I went up there and that's what I started with. But I ran into Tim Sawyer, who was teaching intro psych, and just was just amazed by the stories he would tell about how psychology worked and how the brain processed information. And he was my first introduction that really got me interested in that whole concept of what you just mentioned, of to this very day, just my infatuation with how the brain works. That came from, I think, those classes. And so that got me off in that field. I ended up switching over to psychology. I got my bachelor's and then master's and PhD in psychology. And then, from there, probably I went to Southern Oregon State College back then. It's now Southern Oregon University. And about my second year in, I guess it was, I thought we should be talking to each other. Faculty members should be talking to each other. And so I went to the provost and I said, "Hey, I'd love to like start something where faculty talk to each other. Would that be possible? And I said, well, if you want to do that, you should go to a Lilly conference. And I said, what is this thing you call the Lilly conference? And that would have been back in 1996. So I went to the Lilly conference. It was up at Lake Arrowhead in California. Just loved it. And I talked to Milt Cox and Lori Richmond up there. And I started starting to talk to Milt Cox. He said, you need to go to POD. And so then the next year I went to POD. So Milt Cox was a really strong push for me. And then Lori Richland, who ran all of the regional Lillies back in the day 20 years ago, those two just like watched out for me and really pointed me in some good directions. So Milt Cox and Lori Richland.
Wonderful. How far back do the Lilly conferences date? When were those started?
Next year will be the 40th anniversary of the original Lilly conference.
Amazing.
And then the other kind of branching one started about 3 years later, so they've been around about 35-36 years. I ran my very first one 20 years ago.
Wow.
So now I think I just totaled up the other day. I have now directed 45 Lilly conferences.
Amazing.
Oh my goodness.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Well, I know Brad's been, and he's recruited me to be able to attend a Lilly conference this coming year. But as you observe the topics and the different focuses of the conferences in recent years, what have you found to be the concerns that faculty are striving to solve?
So one of the cool things about running a conference, a lot of people don't understand this aspect of it, and people who attend don't get this either. So here you go. If you're walking into a conference and there are 10 different breakout rooms, next time you go to a conference, look at how big the rooms are. And what you'll find is they'll range anywhere from big rooms to very, very small rooms. And the thing that most people don't understand is that conferences are not easy to run, because before the conference happens, I have to build a program. And if there's a room that holds 50 people and another breakout room that holds like 20 people, I've got to make sure that there's somewhere around 15 to 20 people in the room that holds 20 and around 45 to 50 people in the room that holds 50. Mm. Because if I get those two rooms mixed up and there's only 15 people in a room that holds 50, it looks like the session didn't go really well.
Absolutely.
Like you didn't draw well.
Right.
However, if 15 people show up in a room that holds 20, you think, oh, good, look, the room's pretty well full. Other way around is if we have a room that holds 20 and 50 people want in, then everybody gets irritated because they're standing at the doorway and they can't get in the room. It's like, this conference is oversold and you can't, this is ridiculous. And they don't realize that there's a room down the hall that would have held 50 that only has 15 people in it. So now you have chairs running back and forth. And so it's really difficult to do this. And I come back to your question. So I have to figure out which things go into which rooms based on the draw.
Yeah.
Hmm. And so I'm going to expand the question just a little bit here. You said something about the which are the topics and focus that people are looking for. There's a combination here. What are they looking for? And what needs to be at the conference?
Mm-hmm.
And because sometimes you say, this is what really needs to be there, but it isn't going to draw really heavy, but it needs to be there because it's going to be important.
Yeah.
So I'm going to take this question and say, number one, when I'm ready to put a person in a big room, right now, anything dealing with engagement or somehow integrating the learning of students in online environments fills the room. Those are the biggest rooms we got. Anything that's very specific about how to integrate and do active and engaged learning, those go in the big rooms. Getting students to prepare for classes, the other one.
Okay.
So any of those types of topics, those things go in the big rooms because they're going to draw big. So those are those are the concerns that faculty have, is how do I get students engaged in online courses? How do I get students to prepare for class in any type of learning environment? And then how do I get them working together and integrate those things? And then more and more I'm getting people who are coming for the dynamic lecturing, kind of how do I lecture well? And so those are the big topics.
So if you have those topics, do you find people coming forward with new or novel approaches to those issues?
Oh, all the time.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the really cool thing with the conferences. The thing I really like is that when we're looking at even things like, well, just take, for instance, the Think Pair Share. I mean, I actually have in the conferences, it's like longer sessions have to have some kind of activity or some type of engagement of the participants.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from the Think Pair Share, what will you do in your session? I have to do that because everybody does Think Pair Share.
That's right.
So I've got a blog that's going to be coming out in a couple of weeks. It's kind of like 10 twists tests on the Think Pair Share.
Oh, good.
And so that's what happens too, is that people will come and say, okay, service learning has been around forever and ever, and it's important, but here's a new way of looking at it. Universal design is something that we've been really concerned about for 20 years, although it never seems to really catch on. It's always just on the verge of, it's such an important, wonderful topic that people just don't seem to grab onto. But those types of things is that, you know, we keep seeing adjustments and adaptations and how to do this stuff. And so I think that's what happens. And along with all the research that comes out, people talk about the research all the time. You know, one of the things I love to talk about anytime I get the opportunity is there really isn't clear, good research on the fact that active learning is more effective than lecturing. Mm. It's one of the most pervasive statements out there is active learning is better than lecturing. Mm-hmm. You know what? That's not really even a testable hypothesis, but it's not what the research says. I mean, and quickly people will point out several of the studies that have come out just recently, just like Scott Freeman, who wrote a wonderful meta-analysis out of biologies from UW. But his study doesn't say active learning is better than lecturing. His said that when you add active learning to the classroom, it's better than when you lecture all the time.
Ah.
But what people hear is the active is better than the lecture.
Yes.
And what the research says is the traditional lecture, which is lecture all the time, is less effective than when you bring active learning in the classroom. So you hear the difference there?
Yeah.
And so that's the type of stuff that when people go over the research and they come into their sessions, and also what the faculty are concerned about these days is, what does all this stuff mean? And so that's what I find fascinating. Mm.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, people probably generally neglect looking at the research, and then secondly, teach to their own preferences.
Well, and that's the cool part too. Is here's a quote for you. I've long believed this one too, and I think it's just one of those quotable quotes that I hope gets hung with me at some point. Is people keep talking about how we teach the way we were taught. And the idea is that, you know, a lot of people were lectured to, so then they lecture and folks will roll their eyes and say, well, you know, they teach the way they were taught. I can tell you back in the 70s that I had teachers who used groups, that used team-based learning, that used service learning, that used storytelling lectures. I have experienced lots of different types of teaching in my life. I don't teach the way I was taught. I teach the way I best learned.
Oh,
and so
interesting.
I think faculty teach the way they best learned because that's what makes sense to them. Well, this is how I learned. This must be the best way to learn it. And they forget the fact that there's lots of ways to learn. I really liked Tim Sawyer in his story. The type of lecture he did, which he mostly lectured, was a storytelling lecture.
Mm.
And right now, when I teach, I mostly teach with storytelling lecture and then add in active learning strategies. So I don't teach the way I was taught. I teach the way I best learned.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
Actually, we're going to commission a tombstone with that quote on it for you. We'll start work on that today. So
that one. And I think Brad put that in there.
Okay.
Todd taught the way he best learned. And boy, did he love bacon.
That's awesome.
All right. We'll put one on the front, one on the back. That'll be great. So
That's perfect because you put that one on the back, and that's how you could say it. Okay, this is great. We're getting off sidetrack a little bit, but this is well worth it. Todd lived teaching the way he best learned. Todd died for his love of bacon.
Oh, my goodness. It's perfect.
Excellent. Excellent.
You mentioned what kinds of topics would be covered in those big rooms, but what kinds of topics do you think faculty need to hear that you would present in those small rooms at the conference?
I'm so glad you asked that because that's one that a lot of people, even at conferences, they don't ever really talk about the smaller rooms that really, you know, that had 10 people in there and five people and really changed the way folks looked at things.
Yeah.
So a lot of the topics of diversity go into smaller rooms. And I want to be really careful when I say this, is that diversity is massively important and I will put them on the program. And depending on how it's structured, it can fill a big room, but oftentimes faculty won't go to sessions that are like the importance of diversity in a liberal education.
Mm-hmm.
I can't get people to go into that door. If you have a choice between the importance of diversity for substantiating a liberal education versus top five ways to engage your students. Another room that's three technology tools that can be integrated into any classroom. Another one is to get your students to prepare for class. Nobody's going into that one on the liberal education and diversity because they'll say to themselves, oh, I already believe in education and diversity and I don't really teach liberal education. That's not the point. Right. And that's not the reason for the session. And so I will put that session on the program with a room that will hold 20 people. Sometimes I have rooms that hold 10 people. And I've had folks walk out of those rooms saying that person should be the plenary speaker next year. And so when you talk about the underlining value of diversity, those are hard rooms to sell, but I will always put them on the program. I always have some sessions on service learning because I have long believed it is a massively important and well-designed educational experience, but I'll never get more than 10 or 12 people in there. Anything on universal design, universal learning, along with diversity just hurts my heart that that won't fill a room. Because if you teach, quite frankly, if you use universal design principles, it helps everybody. And so folks will just say, oh, well, I don't believe that students need to be given extra opportunities for things. Everybody should be on the same playing field. It's like, yeah, that's the point. So universal design, it's getting better, but oftentimes I'll have roundtable discussions with universal design that will draw like six people. And then those six people will stand up and say, this was amazing. So those are some of the big ones.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's good to know.
Yeah.
This has been an excellent episode of the Digital to Learn podcast. And we have exciting news. We're going to be bringing this guest back next week for part two. So please join us.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are three things we ask you to do. One, come back and join us again. Two, tell your friends about us. And three, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.